Actually, I have the whole presentation on computer, but it seems it's not needed. And I don't think it will be needed to formally do things. And so I would like to start with or to continue where Rod has left. And I would not agree fully with one of the statements saying that the mantric poetry that Sri Aurobindo takes us beyond mantra, because mantra itself is that particular thing which takes us beyond. So we will deal in linguistic course, we will deal with this concept of mantra first of all, with the Vedic concept of the word, from which, as I think and as the evidence says, Sri Aurobindo took his inspiration. Sri Aurobindo took his inspiration to write Savitri and other poetry and found the language in the Veda first. He found the language of the higher mind, which is very unique and very particular. It's another type of, another way of seeing the world, another way of expressing the truth. For example, the very nature of that Sanskrit, of the Vedic Sanskrit, is such that it is more fluid and more flexible. It is not yet crystallized into the concepts and conceptual forms. It is still alive. It is moving and creating thoughts and ideas. So that language is characteristic to that particular consciousness. In a way, it's a very unique language. You don't find it afterwards. So what we have later in Upanishadic times, we have already a systematization of that knowledge, where the mind is already logically or symmetrically tries to put it into place. Now in the Veda there is no yet placement. In the Veda still there is only an exploration and direct and concrete vision and naming of the experience. As Sri Aurobindo says, if Veda is not logical, yes, it does not confute anything. It doesn't care about, you know, making out of it a system or to prove with one point another point. But Veda even can take two different contradictory, seemingly contradictory logically points and keep them side by side, because they both represent something of the truth. And it doesn't matter that for the logical mind it contradicts. So I thought about this, how it would be really possible to keep two contradictory for the mind points if they represent the truth side by side in one vision. And then if you go deeper into this experience, experiential consciousness which is represented by these statements, you will see that what it does, it widens your perception. It widens your possibilities to see the truth. So if you take true points into one field of perception, but which are not yet fully reconciled by the mind, what it does, it creates a new space in which you can perceive that truth. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It is a device to rise to that consciousness. And that's how Vedic hymns were created. They were made in such a way, as Rishi says, I created for you, O Agni, the vehicle, the car, the chariot, in which we may rise to heaven. If you like this vehicle, my hymn, we can both travel to heaven and bring gods down. So this was the Vedic view. Later language became more conceptualized And there was a shift of paradigms about which I want to speak. The shift of paradigms from Vedic perception to Vedantic, as known as Upanishads, is clearly there, and Shubindu defines it. And there was another shift after Upanishadic towards what we know as Sankhyaic, or Yoga Sutras and so on and so forth, Shastric perception. So that was already a rational, the beginning of rational structure of consciousness. Whereas before we had something which we can call mythical in Gipserian terms, or maybe even magical. Now, Vedic view is somewhat archaic, or something which is original from the beginning of time, where there were no creators. It's apaurusheya, as it is called. It is that level where the verses were not composed by man. They were seen, they were perceived in the highest heaven. They are all there, given to us as formations for all our manifestation later. It's very significant that in India it is understood, and it was preserved in a very particular way over millennia, to bring that knowledge to our times. You know, the generations of Brahmins dedicated their life to a very, accurate preservation of the text. And it is a question why it was done, why it was necessary to do, and I would like also to see how it was done, the technique, and why that technique was chosen, which was really a perfect technique, because when scholars in 19th century, the end of the 18th and the beginning of 19th, came to India and started to collect all those texts all over India. They collected from the north, from the south, Rig Veda, recitation of the Rig Veda. They put these texts and compared them, there was no difference. How come? How come that the text recited in the north in Punjab is the same text recited in Tamil Nadu? In the village, you know, and not somewhere in the center of studies, which is exchanging, and you know, these students are running up and down comparing. Do they do the same way? They never compared. They never met over millennia, because in their village there is a guru who gave his knowledge, and to learn Rig Veda Samhita, 10,000 verses, you have to spend 24 years to really preserve it in your mind. You have to learn from guru immediately, directly, believing everything he says. And that guru got it from his guru, and that guru from his guru. So the tradition which goes in Tamil Nadu in the north was absolutely separate thing, but it preserved the same text. This was a shock for scholars, because they couldn't believe their eyes that the text is the same, accentuation is everywhere the same. But when we look into the technique, we will see how it was possible to really preserve it in that way. Why I'm saying all this? I'm saying this that for some reason, that higher perception of the mantric, of higher mind creating through the word, was essential for our civilization. And it is still to be discovered. It's something which is awaiting its discovery. It's not yet clear what for it was preserved. Now we can see the result. First is Sri Aurobindo. Sri Aurobindo has found in this language, in the Vedic language, the language of his own experience. He could describe it, his experience, by the language of the Veda. He couldn't find it in Upanishads, in the Gita, in Hindu Gita very well. It was another formation already, in another structure of consciousness. It was already more rational. It was explaining to our mind the yoga and what is to be found, but it wasn't really the device yet, not the same language. Since we are dealing with linguistics, I'm saying that the language was different. So maybe this would be the answer for many future poetry studies. What would be that language of a higher mind? And it would be interesting to see in details how this language is formed. First of all, the first feature which is striking is that there are all these gods, many gods, you know, but not endlessly in number, who represent the oneness of the being and consciousness as adjectives.
Each god is an adjective.
Right. It's a name of this one something which presents itself in this particular way or this particular action. Yes? This is a striking thing. First, you can't believe that this is possible. That means it's so approximate, there's nothing concrete, everything is fluid. Agni can be anybody. Agni can be Varuna, Mitra, Rudra, Aryaman, you name it. In particular way of manifesting its consciousness. So Rudra can be any of those gods. They all share, all as brotherhood, they share all their qualities because they are the divine. But in a particular way to manifest, Rudra can use Varuna, or Indra can become with Varuna, or Vishnu. He needs the wideness, cosmic wideness of Vishnu, and he introduces that wideness through his way of doing, through his Indra's way, particular way. Now, these things are not coming from nowhere. They are not only imaginative poetry. They represent some facts of spiritual history of mankind. So by reviewing this linguistic ground, we can kind of recover or can understand those devices which are coming in the future for us to use with the supramental manifestation, because that would be inevitable. We would have to have another language or another mind which will be using other way of speaking or other way of formulating, expressing itself. Now, this is the part of the Vedas from which I would like to move and shift into another Upanishads and see the difference between these two structures. On the Upanishads, we have the whole course. I will not speak today, but it is what is important is that all those faculties which were named in the Veda by the names of the gods, here in Upanishads they are narrowed down to our what we call faculties of consciousness. Yes? They are not yet senses in pure sense as it is used in Sankhya and Yoga. We are speaking still about the word faculty, we speak still about the sight faculty, the mind faculty. We are not mixing them, we are not subordinating them to the mind yet. Mind is still one of the faculties. Later in Sankhya we see that all they are dependent and they are surrendered to the mind and its judgment. Yes, whatever they bring in as indriyas, mind is synthesizing and making judgment of what that material is and places this accordingly. So before they were equal faculties, later they became dependent. So here we have another structure of consciousness which we called mental or rational, where the mind decides what is what and how it should be and makes logic and symmetrical cuts out of this reality. Now Sri Aurobindo deals with this in a beautiful way in this hymn to Indra and Maros, where he explains very well what is to be done. From one side, Indra with his intuitive mind and free intelligence, which is not sense-based, senses are not determining that mentality, has to cooperate with the mind which is coming from below that particular other side about which Rod was talking today, about two evolutionary movements, which two views have to be maintained and synthesized in this new philosophy of evolution, is the sense mind which is growing from the depth of inconscient. Now the sense mind is not the same as that free luminous intelligence, and they have to cooperate. Now once they cooperate, Maruts and Indra, in one being, as Agastya Rishi wanted in his being, there is another possibility of another consciousness. That would be a new consciousness where these two will cooperate and they will build up, as Indra says to Agastya, let this flame to be kindled again in front, and there is the consciousness of immortality. Amritasya Chetanam Tatra, there, in the fire. So once this fire grows within this manifestation, there will be another growth, evolution of consciousness. So the Veda had a glimpse on this particular issue, and Isha Upanishad also, with Vidya and Avidya, these two different types of consciousness have to merge into one Isha's consciousness. It's another view, already Upanishadic later. It would be nice to come back to them in the course of on the evolution of the philosophy of evolution. Now, we are moving towards new understanding when it comes to the rational structure, so we come to Yaska and Panini. Yaska was the first treatise on etymology in 600 BC. It's a very interesting treatise, and I would like to see how he dealt with linguistic categories for the first time. Yes? Before Yaska, there was a text for every shakha, for Rigveda shakha, there was a text of Rig Pratishakya. For Taittiriya Shakha, there was Taittiriya Pratishakya, texts describing how the Vedas should be read. And there were first views on phonology and morphology and syntax and grammar in general in those Pratishakyas. They are unique and very interesting. It's 800 BC. These are first scientific views on language. After that, in 600 BC, we have Yaska with his Nirukta. 500 BC, we have Panini with his Ashtadhyayi, with his Vyakaranam. It's the first treatise on grammar, which is unique. Yeah? Because in 30 pages, if you type all his 4,000 sutras, very short, brief, you type them and you will have 35 pages text. Very small book, that. He describes all grammar of Sanskrit, with all exceptions and all possible variations. Can you do that? Now these scholars study it and they say it's absolutely impossible. It's a computerized way of thinking, and they started to build on it computer systems of thinking, because they, in Japan and Pune University, they have the whole department dedicated to those studies. You see, what he used in his system was so-called principle of anuvritti. Anuvritti means everything he said before is implied in the next, and unless he makes a reference and exception. Now, he doesn't need to repeat his sutras. He doesn't need to come back to that he said before once it was said. Can you imagine such economy of the text? It's first of all. So now the text was studied by heart, so all the connections to this text are not linear. They are kind of building up their own contexts. Yes? But what is interesting, this anuvritti thing, that whatever he said once, so he composed his text in such a way that the most general rules and interpretative rules were spoken before. Now, he has all kinds of rules. He has interpretative rules. He is using language, what we call meta-language. He creates out of language, language for his use. For example, he uses all the vibhaktis, all the cases, for his particular use, with his particular meaning. Now, wherever he will use genitive case would have a particular meaning which otherwise language doesn't have, of substitution. Now, if he uses genitive case, it means that instead of this, this is to be used. This is the interpretative rule for all genitive cases throughout his grammar. That means he is using meta-language, or as it is called, language for the purpose of describing the language. This is something which they are doing now. They are studying in the UK. They have a particular school of economics and philosophy, and they say that studying of Panini liberates your mind because you are using matter language. So you are not fully believing that what you say is what you say, because you always have a look on what you say and how you construct, so you have a freedom in the mind which permits you to analyze in the moment you say. Maybe it's in a way, some interesting way out of that logocentrism in the mind, by the means of the mind. I'm not sure yet, but in a way it's an interesting thought. Now, Panini, it's a big topic. I cannot really dwell on it for now longer than just mentioning it. But in our course we will dedicate the whole hour to this particular Panini view. And I will give you all his books and what he does and what kind of rules he uses. He uses not the way he describes language in five syllogisms. That means he's not describing yes or no, correct, incorrect, yes? He describes yes, better yes, either or, better no, and no. Five options, because the language is more flexible. It's not the way you can deal with language. There are ways where you have alternatives, and there are ways that better this alternative than that in particular context, and better not to use this way, but it doesn't mean you can't use that way. And it is very true. It's much truer in much more alive description than you can give. Now, our grammars will tell you what is right and what is not right, and that is not the way. You will feel always at loss at the end. Now, when we move further into very interesting time, Patanjali's time, and Patanjali's 2nd century BC, it is the first great Mahabhashya, the commentary on Panini. It's 12 volumes, it's a huge thing, where he deals with language in full philosophical overview. It's the beginning of philosophy of language. And there you will find a major shift towards a rational structure of consciousness. And I would speak about it in the course. I will not speak now. How he shifted, and he speaks already in the way how modern linguists are speaking about the language. You can see that he speaks about it as Saussure speaks about it. He says that there is no such thing as meaning of phonema. Meaning of phonema, of the sound, does not exist. It is only the meaning of morphema which exists. This Patanjali, 2nd century BC, the first discovery in Europe, it was done by Saussure of this particular topic, and it was a great beginning of linguistics, that phonema does not have a meaning. Can you imagine 20th century and to the 2nd century BC? Also, he shifts and he makes another overview on Sporta. This is the beginning of Sporta theory from Mahabhashya, where he says that the meaning of the word you have to study not from the linguists, but you have to go to bazaar, place of market, and see how people use language. There you will know the meaning of the word. You can't know it from the lexicon. Lexicon will not give you the meaning. Now, this is the beginning of rational thinking. You can see it clearly. Now, this is the definition which you will find in linguistics nowadays. These are the definitions. And I will show you how he deviates from that Vedic perception of the word. What really he did in his mind, how he cut it into pieces, how he made, what comparisons he made with different words. He takes three words, supa, yupa, and drupa, and supa, yupa, and kupa. And he says all the words have the same accentuation, the same content of phonemes, but only the difference is the first phonema, ks and y. Now, if these are different, so the meaning should depend on them. And it is not. So where meaning comes from? It's exactly Saussurean view. But the point is, what I want to say...
You should tell them who Saussure is.
Yeah, I'm coming to Saussure. I'm on the way to come to that.
2,000 years.
Yes.
Who were you speaking about before?
Patanjali.
It was Patanjali who made these three phonemic...
Yes, I'm speaking now about Mahabhashya of Patanjali. Yes, I'm in his time, 200 BC. So once he compared these three, what he did, he cut off the root. Root is su, ku, and yu. He cut u from su, yu, and ku. And he now says that it has no meaning. He says that as a chariot has a meaning with all its components, you cannot make a meaning of chariot out of the wheel or the central part, or, you know, you can't make sense out of the parts of the chariot. In this movement of chariot, you have to take it as a one single meaningful unit. Now it's very, very rational. It's very mental. The vision which was before was based on the roots, on the single, simple roots from which the derivations were made. If you take that, if you don't demolish root, you will have meanings of ku, su, and yu. What he did is a very strange, very interesting thing. He did something what Greeks did with their alphabet. When Greeks invented alphabet, they actually didn't invent, they took it from Hebrew. But in Hebrew writing, what was there hidden is this accentuation, or the vowels were hidden for the sake of preserving the meaning, or also for the sake of writing paper. Because we have similar runic writing of Slavic tribes, where they also economize on vowels. They knew them. They knew the vowels. They knew the word. The vowel was implied, but it was not written because it took space. Then they started to write vowels on the top. They wrote only consonants and vowels on the top to economize on space. It's a very interesting thing, because the view, the perception of the word was syllabic and never in the sense of alphabet. Alphabet A, B, C, D, A, P is much later. The very way that we say A, B, C, D, we make out of it the syllables, because we can't say A, B, C, D. There are no consonants without vowels. So the syllabic way of seeing the word, and therefore the root and the source from which word comes, has come to an end in Mahabhashya, 2nd century BC. Similar thing what Greeks did to the alphabet. They invented another perception, A, B, C, D. It's another view on the world. There are no more roots. There are no more etymological transparencies. There is nothing to derive from. There is no original system of articulation. There is something mentally given, which has no relevance to the word originally.
They're both mental.
I don't know, yeah.
Intuitive is also mental. Higher mind is also mental.
No, this is okay, yeah.
And supermind is also mental.
No, I mean to say mental in a rational...
Rational, so you should use that term.
Yes. When I say mental, I mean mental or rational structure of consciousness, because I use the shift of paradigm.
You mean empirical and analytical?
Yes.
So mind has more meanings than that.
Right. Well, of course, if you speak philosophically about mind, it's something else.
Yeah.
Now, from Mahabhashya of Patanjali, we move to the time of Bhartrihari, who was the greatest, of course, among the philosophers of language, and it is 2nd century AD, the theory of Sporta and the beginning of a new thinking. Bhartrihari is considered to be the beginning of theory of Sporta. Later in Tantra they are using him for the reference. And I will not speak about Bhartrihari today, because it's already kind of too much already altogether. But from Bhartrihari time and his theory of Sporta, we move to Tantra and Abhinavagupta. which is unique system of seeing the world through the creative word. It's kind of coming back to the Vedic perception of the word by the means of a rational structure. So the rationalizing is there, but it is already overlapping with that particular intuition which Vedas had, to see how they managed with both and why they are not completely, cannot be completely seriously taken by scientific approach, because they try to reconcile between the two in a little bit artificial way here and there. Now, from that time we move to the 19th century or 18th century rather in Europe, and the beginning of Indian Renaissance, when the Sanskrit was discovered. And from that time on, the whole Europe is rising to a new level. Suddenly you have in Germany all these institutions, in France, everywhere, you have new disciplines, you have new humanities, you have comparative philology, you have Indo-European linguistics, you have comparative philology, comparative history, philosophy. It's a new time. Yes? We start with Humboldt and Schopenhauer, and slowly we move towards the time of Saussure. And in Saussure's time we see that because of enthusiasm of Germans, we can say, who wanted to have another origin, Aryan origin, about which they spoke very much, though that was very idealistic. Humboldt is the greatest idealist. He was speaking about new possibilities of mental being. We need a new language for that, more luminous, more fitting to those new possibilities in the mind. We have the interesting shift in all other schools, like Saussure was one of those who were French origin and whom Germans were criticizing, saying that they are flower origin, they belong to this, you know, Latin and Greek, whereas we belong to the Aryan race. And here there was this shift which made impossible to continue Indic studies in Europe in 20th century. And we know the First and Second World War were generated by Germans on the ground of that superior consciousness. And we know that Second World War, they were calling themselves Aryans and so on and so forth. It was all generated on that ground, after which all these Indic studies and Vedic became some kind of taboo in Europe and in the West. Now nobody wants even to look into that direction, because they are afraid that this kind of thing may come back, or not even afraid, but because there is a memory there still of that misuse. I'm saying to you this because it's a particular thing which nobody thinks about, but if you look deeper and see 19th century, you will see how different it was than 20th century. That's why Saussure, whom we consider to be the father of theoretical linguistics in Europe, at least, and structuralism, he was the Sanskrit scholar. He was the Sanskrit teacher for 20 years in the university. It is now not even mentioned that he knew Sanskrit. If you read on the website, any website, you just take Saussure and all Encyclopedia Britannica, whoever speaks on Saussure, it's just somewhere there in the corner, the last thing to be said, yes? But it was exactly the main topic. His PhD was on genitivus absolutus in Sanskrit language, which is very difficult syntactic construction. If he knew genitivus absolutus, how it works, I assure you, he knew inside out Sanskrit linguistics. Now, on that ground, Saussure develops very interesting new structuralism, new way of seeing linguistics. He suddenly offers another naming of the what was there before of the concept and the word expressing that concept, to call it signifier and signified. It's nearly a translation of that what Bhartrihari calls vachaka and vachya. It's an exact word-by-word translation. That which is to be named, signified, and vachaka, that which is signifying that, which is to be signified. Now these two components, they build up what he calls one sign. And this sign is the beginning of new linguistics. The studies of this sign is now considered to be linguistic study. All the rest is something else. Now, he moves further, and he, at the end of his life, because of his sharp mind, he excludes, unfortunately, from these studies of linguistics, the studies of the sound, because he says sound has no meaning. It's all relative. Every language has its own set of sounds, meaning the same thing with different words. I give you 20 different languages naming the same chair with different names, so it's obviously not in the sound. Yeah? But that is already, the origin of the root is lost. Yes. If we come back to Sri Aurobindo, we will see the future of linguistics, where he tries to recover that in the system of etymons, simple root sounds, which from which you can derive any name for the chair. Because from every root you can arrive at to this contextual meaning to support you to sit. Yeah? So it can have many different meanings which Saussure didn't see yet. So for Saussure it's only arbitrary thing. Sound is arbitrary and meaning also is arbitrary. The meaning was also excluded from the studies of linguistics and given, so to say, future possibilities of what he called semiotics, which became later the science of the meaning. Now, but semiotics deals with the science, with the meaning in a particular way, as a rather syntactics or structural semantics. It never came to the meaning of the etymon or the meaning of the word. So the word has no meaning, according to Saussure. It has only a meaning relative in comparison to other meanings within the structure, within the language. He says that the meaning comes from the value which is prior to signification and prior to the signified. So the signified and signifier is only a device, secondary device, which the meaning, which the body of a human collective carries within itself, is being expressed. You know? It's always secondary. It's an interesting view. It's a very valid view to look into it. It makes sense.
And it's interesting to notice in modern philosophy of current philosophy of evolution that the debate between the empiricists and the idealists turns on this problem. You have a debate between Daniel Dennett and Noam Chomsky, between the empirical philosopher and the linguistic philosopher, about evolution and whether the structure is prior to language or whether language is the result of this construction from observation and use. And so the way that the science of evolution is currently moving is moving exactly on the same principles and debates, because information theory is now taken to be the best way to understand evolutionary genetics. And so the idea of the philosopher Whitehead, that language is human nature is language, brings the two sciences into a very concrete relationship. Right now, biology and language are being studied on exactly the same basis.
Because of semantics, yes? But the problem is here that that system from which the meaning in the sound is not recovered. And because systematically it is not seen, what they would deal with only with structures. Structures which are mental. Mental structures, which is all right, yes? The word is here only to sound and to indicate to those structures. That's where Chomsky ends with his deeper structures. And basically none of them could recover or even dare to think in those terms.
It's for a new language.
And I'm saying it because I'm daring to offer this another view in this course at the end, where you would see language absolutely with different eyes. That there is a system of sound meaning behind which is related to our possibilities to articulate certain psychological states which are primary meanings which we don't see anymore, but poets, they feel this. They feel very sharply the difference between synonyms. No, if I take synonymia, why poet is using a big or great or immense ocean or infinite ocean? What would be the difference between these meanings? In the mind, it stays the same as synonymous, but in the perception of consciousness, it's absolutely different. Immense ocean is different from big ocean. And we all feel that. It's not only feeling, it's something more than feeling. It's the way how we articulate it, it's the way how we understand it, it's the way how we relate with it through the sound meaning which we have no idea about anymore in a systematic way. But it might be that there was a proposition, Shubhendu makes this proposition, to recover the original system of etymons, because it is relating inevitably to our possibilities to articulate. We have limited possibility, I'm showing it like this because there are 5 levels of articulation only, there are no more, only 5 in this apparatus of articulation, and they all build up the whole system of original sound etymological system, which is transparent in Sanskrit only. But what is interesting, we can bring also Latin and Greek into this study and see how much closer they are to that original system than any other language. Take any, English, open the dictionary and see that meaning is jumping from word to word, completely in different directions.
If you take a name like Aphrodite,
yeah,
and you see how what all it is combined and how many roots come from that, those sounds in Greek. It's, if you have the time to do that, it's quite beautiful.
But if you open a Sanskrit dictionary or Latin or Greek and you read word by word, when words are changing, yes, articles on words, you will see that the meaning is changing gradually, never jumping, very related, very close, contextually close. What is this? So the sound and meaning were going together in one system. They are not deviating. They are not only signification for some arbitrary meaning. I cannot call it within the setup of English language this something else than chair or armchair. It's not really fully permitted.
The word arbitrary has to be examined also.
Well, I'm using it arbitrary.
So, if meaning emerges through a developmental evolutionary process, still, each moment of discovery is new. There is novelty. There is not predetermination.
And
that development.
And there is a predetermination at the same time, because apparatus is fixed. Now notice, interesting thing. Apparatus is fixed, possibilities to articulate and to sound.
So in evolutionary theory, that's called constraint.
Okay.
there are constraints in the phenome, the phenotype, which make development not absolutely arbitrary or predetermined.
You see, arbitrary is a good word.
But constrained within certain boundaries. Within those boundaries, there can be unlimited possibilities.
Exactly. And that's what Sri Aurobindo says. He says 50 roots, original, simple roots of Sanskrit language, he can arrive at any meaning of those roots from any root. The flexibility of the mind, you can arrive to any meaning of those original roots from any root, only you have to see it, and you have to have ability to see how you arrive. Now this ability we lost. This is ability of a higher mind. That's what I want to conclude with for this introduction. And if we can recover that ability through the studies of Sanskrit and linguistics, that will be the contribution of this course. Well, it's a huge claim, of course. Upanishads, I will not make any introduction because it's a huge thing, and you are most welcome, and the course is running. And it is interesting to study these texts. They are ancient and wonderful and profound, and we are discussing them at length and in detail, every shloka, every word, every concept there on the spot.
And there's a cross fertilization that's possible between poetry and Sanskrit and evolution and linguistics, which we haven't discovered yet, but it's a possibility.
It's already is being discovered.
I find it very interesting that the two first courses or four courses offered from Ubud, and it so happens that you collaborated, and that, how to say, that the word and speaking and its function as consciousness or a means for a new consciousness, that this is basically what we're starting off with. I just find it very much on the point.
And we need word and hearing connection, which you have to offer, and then we would have the whole more or less complete kind of approach to the word. Because here we don't have yet that particular, which you did, that course on hearing and using the word as a hearing device. Now, yes?
And I find it especially interesting because you emphasized, I mean, how much importance Sri Aurobindo gave on the poetry and the role of the word, possibly you can say even in the manifestation of a new consciousness. So I'm quite, how to say, happy that we're starting off with that, because it seems to be, and you now explain it historically, how the use of the word and the reflections on language, how they actually go simultaneously with states of the shifting of
consciousness.
And so there you have it. So basically our focus on the word and on language basically is like one of the first, possibly most important instrument towards entering into consciousness. Whatever study comes out of that, so I'm quite glad it's like really starting on the essence. Okay, then if there's an understanding and awareness of the word and of the use of word and sound and meaning, whatever subjects we're dealing with later on that base could be already, with a new approach. And a new way, and the possibility of letting the consciousness work.
Actually, what can be mentioned here to support your view, which you are expressing as in Gipserian way, that basically all these structures of consciousness expressed in particular way, knowing how their language functioned in that particular structure, knowing not only theoretically, but knowing also psychologically, because they are all these ways are living within us. They can be recovered. and they can build up that integral structure at the end about which he speaks, the integral stage.
I have two questions that to your course of content-wise. It would be very interesting. What's missing, I think, if I take a look at the global perspective, is the Chinese approach and the pictural, ideographic approach to language. And what reflects that in this in consciousness, and in your layout, because for Sri Aurobindo, he actually mentioned that his study of Tamil and his context with Tamil gave him actually the clue. So in those texts you have Tolkappiyam, which falls in between what, around Panini, between Panini and 2nd BC, what you said. And that would be very interesting to see what that text offers also into the picture. Because it's basically, I think it's one of the oldest and the first written texts of in Tamil language.
All right.
Which is basically also on grammar and etymology and linguistics. And also interesting to see that some of the very first written texts are from the culture that are actually dealing with the word.
Maybe the Chinese and Buddhistic approach is somehow inherently different.
Yeah. It's like almost like a different, how do you say,
It's a silent approach, and this is the sound approach.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Well, Buddhists wrote a huge number of texts. They like to speak silent, but somehow to be silent you have to really know what to say. You can't be silent without the word meaningfully.
It's interesting to know if the Chinese actually have lots of reflective studies on their way of using
it. Yeah.
Of course they have.
You know, you said a minute ago that maybe through studying linguistics we get back to this original sense of language, but I think it's going to require more of an integral approach.
Mm.
And so if we can begin to add to it an audio and visual dimension, you know, if people can do graphics and bring other kinds of symbols into play with this process of study, it makes it more living and movement and practice and chakras and so on. You know, it's important to get the whole complex structure of consciousness involved.
Because on a similar strain, you could see, and just mentioning, as you talked about the development of language, you can also, I mean, many times in my mind, I looked at the, while you spoke, at the evolution of music and the changes.
Yeah.
And then when Sasuke came up, what happened parallel to music? You know, that the meaning and sound was not there, and it was all emphasized on structure, you know, and then how it shifts in the music activity of humanity through evolution. Very interesting parallels.
Mm.
So Whitehead's view of this philosophical process is that one part of it is allowing the self-evident to reveal itself, and then the more difficult part of it is to express that which is self-evident. And that expression can be linguistic, or it can be artistic, it can be poetic, or it can be analytical, or whatever. But the first necessity is to allow that to emerge which is true, the self-evident, true consciousness, and then to express it in a way that is true to it. And then you can see in that the way logical thinking has evolved, where truth has now come to mean true to something else, and not the something else. The symbol is true if it's an accurate representation of something. But what is that something? We get stuck on the representations, and we lose contact with the something, which is actually the truth in which consciousness is grounded. And so to evolve an ability to reveal that which is without making an exclusive concentration on the symbol itself is also something that has to be relearned.
What he just describes is exactly how Pashyanti is using the Madhyama. Because the intuition comes in flashes, and then it comes to some grounds which you can offer for embodiment of that intuition. You can offer it one language or another, or one system of symbols as a language, yes, as a musical system, or as a painting system, or any other visual set of symbols which will be used by that flesh, or you can offer it as a poetic or expression in the word. So the Pashyanti will always flash down, yes? The spirit will always try to come and to manifest in this, in languages we offer it to manifest. So our Madhyama is a system which that Pashyanti created prior for its later coming down and using it and improving it and making it evolve.
Interesting in the context of yoga, because I once was in North India and that person was choking and said, you know, all the gurus, they give all the different techniques, and Sri Aurobindo had his students writing poetry. So, and that was his yogic technique, basically, we were asking. And you can say, we have lots of references from the disciples that actually poetry was used as the primal yogic technique. But then to progress, you know, they opened themselves and they said, sir, 4 o'clock in the afternoon will be okay, you know, just to sit and see what's happening. Yeah, we can do. And so, how to say,
the same with Vedic.
We don't have, what are the techniques to integral yoga? Definitely, in Sri Aurobindo practicing and working with the disciples, poetry was one of the foremost ones. And Mada used, the Kama Yoga, yoga of action, and activities and organizations and the whole
but also painting
flowers.
So along with these pursuits there should flow creative expressions. Mm-hmm. And so anyone who has something to offer in the way of flow, you know, increasing the flow, should participate in that way. I think the poetry exploration should be taken as a way of opening, you know, using Sri Aurobindo's poetry as a real elevating, liberating influence, not at all something to be analyzed. Mm-hmm. And then combining that with the Upanishadic imagery, the way to understand existence, the worlds and the planes, we should be able to communicate what we see. We should be able to begin to use language and images, colors and movements, tones, in a way that's meaningful. So I would like there to be participation in that way. You know, if someone is inspired in some way by the understanding which develops, then it should be expressed, and we should all benefit from that expression. Mm-hmm. Participate in it.
If I have a question going along with the language, this present work is a message.
Just speak a bit loud.
Yeah. I said, going along with the language, what Radhanev talked about, the classical Indian music, back in the Rag system, it's really, same way.
It has the same
Like the Vedic system. Mm.
Yeah. And this is quite interesting.
Yeah.
So at any time that someone wants to make a presentation which fits into and enhances
the process,
their course, you know, that I welcome that.
Actually, yeah, we are moving into the second stage.
Open that space.
Yeah, we are moving into the second round of our, before we just explored what we had, yes, last year. Now the time is to create some applications, yes, some fields where we will learn. So we cannot stay detached, we have to involve. So please be involved. I hope that you will be involved and do something there. Because I know the potential is waiting to be kinetically explored.
I just want to say something on the time curve, because you started off and said, yeah, and Shrivindu definitely went, his approach to mantric poetry goes beyond the mantra. And then you said, well, mantra anyway has to do with going beyond. But then you said, but he got his inspiration from the Vedic. I think what's happening, let's say, in the evolutionary context, we basically, how to say, facing like a full 12,000 years cycle, if you look when the Vedic thing was there. And we, in one way, we're coming to that place, but definitely it's not closing the circle. There's, it has to be a spiral. It has to open into a new octave. So you can say, there is the same there. That's why Sri Aurobindo could also receive his inspiration, because it's ripe. It went through a full cycle, and of course he's bringing it into a new opening and octave, into a new...
So he speaks a lot about bringing it down, bringing the overmind, direct intuition and sound, the source of inspiration, bringing it down to the mental and vital plane. And he says in his letters, there's only an occasional line among the whole works of a poet that show an influence from that plane of inspiration, which is the source. So what he was working on with his disciples and in himself was to try to put the creative mind in touch with that which has not yet found the vehicle. So in the Vedic, you know, he comments on the Vedic poets as having received from it their lights, but actually making that plane, you know, we speak of the mental plane, which has higher mind and intuitive mind, which is just another branch of mind. Rational and analytic is another branch of mind. These are branches of mind which is evolving. But there is overmind, which contains, he says, all of the inspiration for poetry and creativity and whatnot. Not even yet beginning, he says, not even yet beginning to think about supermind. And so to access or to allow that plane of consciousness to enter into our field of knowing and expressing is one of the aims of yoga. And that one thing that I said in my introduction in writing, which I didn't say orally, is about this. The way Sri Aurobindo solves the mind-body problem is by saying that mind is an integral part of life and matter. And so the pressure of mind is evolving in this threefold world, intellect, rational perception, intellect, inspiration, intuition. These are evolving streams of mind within the context of this physical, vital, mental prakriti. The way he solves the problem, the mind-body problem, he says those are all one integrated thing. Purusha is not those things. Purusha is either involved in those things, or liberated from those things, or at a higher level, the dynamic unification of those things. But it is not Prakriti. It is self. So the duality is not mind and body. The duality is Purusha Prakriti. And all of these things that we're talking about, mind, language, understanding, inspiration, all of that is Prakriti. Self is the other. And that other in yoga can be involved, it can be detached, or it can be mastered. So at that higher level, there is another duality, which is Ishvara Shakti. But that is a duality which is not a duality, it's a unity. So whenever we speak about mind, normally if we speak about it in a derogatory way, we're just talking about practical, physical mind and analytical understanding. But we're not really talking about mind then. We're talking about a level of mind. So evolving higher mind is necessary for bringing down over mind. And that's necessary in order to transform matter. So the mother can easily say, I've left behind the mind, right now I have the direct descent into the material. But she's still meeting with Sat Prem every week, talking about her experience. So she's not just doing the yoga in the physical. She's also commenting all the time upon her experience of that thing which is happening. And so she's not using the analytical, theoretical mind in a big way, but she's keeping the mind in contact with what's going on and speaking through normal language about it. Sri Aurobindo was all the time doing this yoga of transformation and building the overmind contact through poetry, making it concrete, you know, building the connection with language, with the higher levels of mind. And he was doing that with his disciples because for him, that was the route to the body. The descent, he says, it has to come down into the mind and even the vital and even the physical. So, at a very advanced stage, the mother could say that the transformation is going on directly between the supermind and matter. But there's all of that building the structures for that process which has to happen. Some have to do that. Not everyone has to do that, perhaps. But some have to do that. That is the yoga of Sri Aurobindo. Of course, I can certainly understand that there might be other points of view on that question. I don't mind hearing other points of view on that question.
Question about today, there won't be an afternoon session.